Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we will touch on a topic that we have discussed on and off, I'm sure, many times over the years, and that's juvenile justice here in the United States. And our guest for the program is Joseph Ryan. He is assistant professor of social work here at the University of Illinois and a faculty fellow in the Children and Family Research Center that's housed in the School of Social Work. As we talk in this first hour, questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, you can pick up the telephone and call and be a part of the conversation. All we ask of people who call is that they're brief so that we can accommodate as many as possible, keep the program moving. But anyone who is listening is also welcome to be a participant. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Glad to be here.
We appreciate it. Just something I thought it was interesting to talk about here at the beginning, or to use kind of as a jumping-off point, is a poll that was done, and the results were released earlier in the year in February. It was a poll by Zogby International. It was commissioned by the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, asking people questions about the issue of youth crime and how we should deal with youthful offenders. And apparently one of the things that they found out was that 9 out of 10 people who responded to the survey believe that rehabilitation and treatment for incarcerated youth can help prevent future crime, and 8 out of 10 thought spending money on rehabilitative services and treatment for youth would save money in the long run. And I guess I found that encouraging that many people would say, yes, I actually believe in the idea of rehabilitation for youthful offenders and the fact that we should be putting money into that. And I suspect if we did a survey like that and we asked people what they thought about adult criminals, adult offenders, that we wouldn't have anything near that level of support for the idea of rehabilitation. So it seems like we like to believe that it's possible for people to change, at least when they're young. So having said all that, what I wonder is if you take a look at the juvenile justice system and look at what we actually do, does that reflect this kind of popular belief in the idea of rehabilitation, do you think?
Well, I think if you took it sort of one question further and asked them how they would go about rehabilitating juvenile offenders, then you would start to see a great sort of divide between what one might think of as treatment services, let's say mental health, let's say issues around family violence, versus more correctional style interventions like boot camps, group homes, secure detention facilities. There's this great tension that's been ongoing for decades with regard to how to best intervene with juvenile delinquency. And, you know, it's this idea that these deterrent style programs may be the most effective. That's sort of our popular belief, sort of hard times, hard crimes mentality. And so I think people clearly believe that juveniles, adolescents can be rehabilitated and go on to live productive lifestyles. But the question is how to go about doing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, then I guess that prompts a question. If you then take a look at those two different approaches, on the one hand, one that recognizes that problematic behaviors can come out of problematic family circumstances, and you look at where kids live and how they grow up and what's happening in their families and what their schools are like and what their neighborhoods are like, and the idea that they need a lot of positive kind of supports in their life, and that though we ought to essentially keep them with their families and make sure that they do go to school and, you know, do whatever we can to address it short of putting them in some kind of youth detention facility. So that's the one. The other would be say, okay, yes, we recognize they're different from adult defenders, offenders, but we need to put them in some place where their freedom is restricted. Whether that is boot camp or some other kind of facility that's just dedicated to young people, that really that's what we should be doing. You know, if we're saying, look, they committed crimes, particularly if they're serious crimes, we just can't let them be on
the street. Absolutely.
So what is there research that shows that one or the other of those approaches is more effective?
Sure. And it's really not necessarily one or the other. It could be, in fact, a combination. I mean, clearly you have public safety issues to worry about. So if you have an adolescent in your neighborhood who's stealing cars, you know, property crimes are the most frequent type of offense. Incapacitation, incarceration of this child is clearly in the interest of public safety, one approach. But the research is clear on that these programs, if that's all they offer, so mm-hmm. if a child, the idea, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, residential programs, the idea was we remove a child from the community, we work with that individual child, we try to instill new values, beliefs, attitudes, morals, and then we return the child to the family thinking that this inoculation approach might actually work. And in fact, it doesn't work. The research is clear. We got about 100,000 adolescents in the United States in sort of correctional style programs today on any given day. And these programs simply are not as effective as working with families in their community, sort of in the context which these behaviors have evolved.
Mm-hmm. Well, just going back for a second to your point about once you get past asking people, do you believe in the idea of rehabilitation for young offenders? And they say, yes, I do. Then if we go to the next question, then we ask people, okay, how do you think we should accomplish that? Is there then, do you think that there is greater levels of support for the idea of some kind of what amounts to incarceration, that is in some kind of secure facility? Is there more support for that than this, than the other kind of idea that says it's really going to be more effective if we work with children in their families and in their communities?
Well, I mean, I think if you did the general poll, probably not. I mean, I think mm-hmm. people would favor mental health services, family support services. But if we look at the policies and programs, they're not structured that way. Mm-hmm. And in part, you know, I mean, what politician could run on a platform of treatment services for juvenile offenders? So the programs are not structured that way. The funding is not structured towards prevention efforts. We wait until an offense occurs. So this idea that, you know, money could be spent up front, you know, after school programs. The majority of delinquent offenses occur between, say, 2 and 6 p.m. It's time when, you know, adolescents are essentially out of school, parents are still at work, commuting home. If communities put in, say, $300 per child for some structured activities in a community, we might see lower rates of problematic behavior. But the funding is really not structured to do that. We would rather wait around until a delinquent offense and perhaps a more serious delinquent offense occurs, and then we're willing to commit 20, 30, 40 grand a year, in fact, perhaps for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm. If the only thing you were concerned about was money, what would be the most cost-effective approach? Which would it be?
Well, the cost-effective is clearly community-based and family-oriented programs. Not the most popular, but that is the research is clear that that's the most effective. That's the context with which these behaviors are learned and supported. To think we can remove a child from that context and try to teach them something new and return them to the exact same environment from which they came doesn't make much sense. It's not efficient and it's not effective.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that's, you know, maybe you wouldn't be surprised at that because it seems to me that overall our approach to the idea of crime addressing crime is also the kind of after the fact thing. I mean, you know, the idea that we could do something to deter crime. That doesn't seem to be as appealing to us as the idea that, well, we need to make sure that we really are tough when people commit crimes. And then when you get into talking about things like, well, for people who've been in jail, There are various kinds of things we could do to try to keep them from going back, various kinds of educational services and counseling services. And probably one of the big things that we could do was provide some treatment for substance abuse issues. And if we did all the kind of things like that, maybe we could cut down on recidivism. But there again, that's a really hard sell to get people to say, okay, yes, I'm willing to spend my tax money on programs like that.
Right. And the other, the other difficulty with any prevention program is no one likes to pay for a problem that's yet to emerge. Mm-hmm. There's communities just are not willing to put forth money towards these problems that may occur or may not occur 10 years down the road.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Joseph Ryan. He is Assistant Professor of Social Work here at the University of Illinois. He's also Faculty Fellow in the Children and Family Research Center in the School of Social Work, and we're talking about juvenile justice in the United States. We do have a caller here, so why don't you go ahead and put on those headphones, and for people who are listening, questions, comments certainly are welcome. 333-WILL or 9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. The caller is nearby in Belgium, over near Danville, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I heard an interesting fact recently that kind of tells the whole story. In the state of Texas, they had a referendum that voted down $750 million for schools, but accepted $1 billion for prisons. Now, that seems to just tell the whole story, doesn't it? I mean, they're not willing to, people are not willing to approach the problem in the beginning, which may help more than just the students that'll be bad, but help everybody in the community. But they don't want to do that. They just want to keep paying for more and more prisons, keep putting more and more people in jail. I guess that goes along with what you just were talking about, but it's kind of a telling fact, don't you think?
Definitely. Clearly the idea that we would rather wait around for a problem to emerge and then shell out, tens and 20s and $30,000 per child, perhaps for the rest of their life, as I mentioned. There's about 2,000 or 2,500 adolescents now who are in adult correctional facilities serving life sentences without parole. So clearly we're committed to dedicating the resources once the offenses occur. The question is, can we move it back towards this prevention side, spend a lot less, and actually achieve far better results?
Yeah, the thing I'm really getting at, though, is they're willing to spend more for correction than they will for education. It's less expensive to do it in the beginning than it is in the end, which doesn't seem to... Why do we do this? Why do we continue to go down this same path? Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. I don't know. There's a rhetorical question. I know you don't have an answer for it. I'm not sure anybody really does have an answer for it, but we have a tough time with the, no matter what it is we're talking about, it seems like we have a tough time with the idea of prevention, about doing something there. We're willing, once we have a problem, we seem to be willing to spend money on that, whether that be crime or whether that be health problems or whatever it is we're talking about. But selling people on the idea of spending money up front, even when you say to them, if we spend it up front, we're going to spend less money if we spend it later, somehow that's a
sure.
Very difficult argument to make.
Absolutely. I mean, the only programs we see sort of prevention-related are, say, the DARE programs and the Scared Straight programs. Both programs have tremendous public appeal, but the evidence doesn't support either one.
Hmm. Just let me ask you, it seems that within the last, maybe a couple of decades, within popular press, there has been more and more, or a fair number at least, of articles and attention devoted to children, juveniles who commit very serious crimes. And the idea, it made it sound as if there were a growing number of young offenders that were, in a sense, committing crimes that we thought of as adult, we put that in quotes, I'm not even exactly sure what that means, but, very serious crimes. And also accompanying that, I guess, is our increasing willingness to say that juveniles should be put into the adult justice system, should be tried like adults, and then should be sentenced like adults. If you take a look at serious crimes committed by young offenders, has that number, in fact, gone up? Have we seen a big increase in various serious, particularly violent crimes committed by young offenders?
No, in fact, haven't. In the last, you know, our delinquency rates now, and even for violent offenses, is as low as it was in 20 years ago. The delinquency rate overall is in a general decline, despite a minor uptick in the last year. And so we haven't seen that. In the early 90s, we clearly saw there was these predictions around this emerging super predator. These bands of youth who very young offenders, not your typical, say, 15, 16, 17-year-old offender, but 11, 12, 13. And there was a real fear that these kids were going to turn into monsters, essentially, and long-term chronic violent offenders. And that's when we saw changes in statutes related to when we would try youth as adults, backing it up 17, 16, and even, you know, and then the idea of waiving a youth being waived to adult court and the elimination of any minimum age for youth. So there was clearly a fear around that, but it never materialized.
But that did translate into policy, though.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, but the policies are based in part on public perceptions. So are these youth committing adult-style crimes so that they deserve adult time? But then there's also this financial debate going on. So who should bear the burden of these costs associated? So, for example, Connecticut, you can be 16 years old. If you're 16, you're considered an adult in Connecticut. And they'd like to back it up to 15. And this idea that it's more cost-effective to serve these apparently violent youthful offenders in adult correctional systems because they get fewer services. But the problem with that is it translates into higher recidivism rates.
Do we have now more young offenders in adult prisons?
No, actually, that we have fewer, say, than compared to 2002. But clearly, as those laws changed in the mid-90s, early 90s, late 90s, there was an increase in that, and the movement of youth being waived and serving blended sentences, serving part of their time in juvenile facilities and then moving into adult facilities.
Because I think certainly one of the things that has been a concern all along about juvenile justice is the problems that can come with mixing juveniles with adults and taking young offenders, juveniles, and putting them into facilities that were designed for adults, and essentially that's what you have there. And I think that seemed to be a big concern of a lot of people, is that should not happen. There are probably places that it does still. Is that something that how are we doing on that in trying to make sure that we have those two separate populations and we want to keep them separate?
Right. Well, the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act essentially separates the sight and sound sort of clause, this idea that juveniles need to be out of sight and out of sound of adult offenders. Mm-hmm. But it also relates, the same principle relates to the youthful correctional facilities. If, in fact, there's a problem with congregating offenders together, regardless of age, right? It's this idea that it's making the problem worse. They're learning from the other inmates, or correct? Mm-hmm. That's the exact same problem with the youthful correctional facilities. You're congregating groups of high-risk offenders together for long periods of time with limited supervision. So the same reason we should be separating juvenile and adult offenders to some extent, I mean, you got a victimization issue in the adult facilities. Really, the argument could be placed in the juvenile correctional facilities as well, these group homes where we get, you know, 10 and 12 adolescents together who have, histories of maltreatment and delinquency. Putting them together is a problem.
How are we addressing that?
Well, there's movements to sort of use more community-based style programs to eliminate group home style placement. So rather than congregate 10 and 12 adolescents together, try to serve them in smaller programs, 4 or 5 individuals, family style, sort of almost a foster family style approach in juvenile justice, as well as shortened correctional stays and then a focus on aftercare, these transitional services, so that we don't, you know, it's not that you open the door in a correctional facility and a child goes home, but there's some transition between the residential program and what's being received in the community.
Well, maybe you could talk a little bit about more about, from the research that you've been involved in and other people have done, what kind of approach really does work. I mean, what if you had your way and you could say this is the, based on what we know, the ideal kind of way of dealing with youthful offenders, particularly when they're younger and the nature of their offenses are not as serious as they might be, you know, at the point where you really think that you might be able to intervene to prevent that child from then going on to committing much, much more serious and, you know, potentially more violent kind of crimes.
You should, you know, think about sort of services in a continuum care approach where we have sort of the least restrictive being an adolescent being served in his home with his family, receiving, say, mental health services if necessary, substance abuse services, all the way up to restrictive residential correctional style programs. Mm-hmm. And youth are moving up if necessary, but, you know, hopefully down this continuum. And they're not sort of dropping in, say, at the correctional style approach and then being returned home. But actually, if they do fall anywhere on this continuum, it's a gradual approach, moving back down. So always ending up or beginning with working with the family in the community.
Are there places where you think that they are doing a particularly good job, and at least that have that kind of range of services available?
Well, I mean, all states and all counties have these services available, but the question is, are they being used? You know, the other thing I probably would mention is assessment on the front end to really get a handle on what these adolescents actually need and what services could best fit that need. We don't really see that in social service in general, be it child welfare or juvenile justice. The general approach is we give children and families everything we have, anger management classes, substance abuse sessions, mental health counseling. For the families, we give them domestic violence counseling. Regardless of the problem, it's sort of this mentality, we give them everything, hope something sticks, and that's our approach, rather than sort of more targeted approach, figuring out what children, adolescents, families need, and then matching our services to those individual needs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that part of the issue there is that to do that, that's labor intensive on somebody's part, that you need to have plenty of caseworkers, people whose job it is to go into the home and spend some time talking with the family and getting some sense about what their particular problems are, what their particular needs are, getting them hooked up with services. That what I'm sure what that means is person hours, and that seems also, though, to be something that, at least historically, and I'm sure probably still the case, that's one of the places where the resources are the most thin, that we probably don't have enough people to just do that job. That just means a lot of investing a lot of person hours in each individual family and each individual case.
Clearly, it would involve a little more in terms of hours on the front end assessments. But the alternative is we have a one size fits all mentality to mm-hmm. a variety of social problems. And think of the individuals and the obstacles that now these families have to navigate. They have to get to the parents counseling, parent training. They have to get to substance abuse. They have to get to their anger management class. They have to get to their domestic violence. So it shares the burden of costs onto these various other state agencies, like, say, someone paying for the mental health services. But it's not a cost-effective approach to dealing with this problem. I mean, we wouldn't think that all delinquency emerges for the same reason. These kids didn't all end up in the juvenile court for the same reason. So to give everyone sort of a group of everything and hope that that would work might not be the most cost-effective approach. Mm.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Joe Ryan. He is assistant professor of social work and faculty fellow in the Children and Family Research Center. That's in the School of Social Work here at University of Illinois. We're talking about juvenile justice in the United States. And questions certainly are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. People can join the conversation very easily by picking up the telephone and calling us here in Champaign-Urbana, 1-800-333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. How actually, I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about this. How is it determined, and have we changed the way we think about whether or not, if we have a young offender, you know, say somebody who's 16 or 15 or 17, we decide whether that person should be tried and treated as an adult or as a juvenile. How do we, and I don't know, maybe from place to place, the way that we make that decision is going to be different.
Right. It does vary place to place. There's a few states that if you're 16, you're an adult. Here in Illinois, it's 17. And then you have waivers as well, where judges, discretionary waivers, can consider the facts of a case and waive that petition to adult court. Mm-hmm. And so it varies. It varies within states. It could vary between judges, and it's depending on the nature of the offense and the adolescent's history as well. And so that's where we see other sort of problems, especially sort of moving from the child welfare system. The youth coming from the child welfare system have a more checkered past than, say, delinquents from the general population. And so these youth are then more likely to end up in correctional-style programs and even waived into adult court.
We have a couple of callers here, actually both of them on cell phone, so we'll take them as they came in. So the first person is on line 4. This is the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I want to go back to the rhetorical question and see if there is any evidence, scholarly evidence, for reasons why we don't take a cost-effective or rational theory approach to these problems. And let me just deal with three possible ways and reasons why we might not. Could there be evidence that a certain portion of the youth population is just genetically inclined towards crime? That's one. Two, that there is a deeply embedded racism in our society, and therefore we do not want to invest in what we think are racial minority youth. And third, the degree to which our own culture of individualism, that kids, even youth, are responsible for behavior. Any evidence on any of those three?
Well, I don't know anything about genetics research and whether individual youth are predisposed and whether we'll always have a group of individuals, regardless of our response, that are predisposed. The second point you made about racism is clearly a factor, and that's a factor at every decision-making point in the juvenile justice system. And it's clear, even backing it up to younger children, it's at every decision point in the child welfare system. This is from the arrest. This is from the decisions whether to dismiss a case. This is the decision of whether to adjudicate a case. And this is the decision about sentencing or disposition, as they refer to it in the juvenile justice system. So clearly racism is a factor. And I wasn't able to sketch down the third one.
I guess it had something to do with our commitment to individualism and the idea that perhaps that people are ultimately responsible, for their own actions, and that they decide what they're going to do. They decide are they going to obey the law or not. And I suppose then if that's the way that you believe it and we say, well, that's a matter of personal decision, then there could be really no question. That would argue for a much more punitive approach because it would underlying that would be this idea that, well, if someone breaks the law, that's their choice. And if that's their choice, then they simply need to face the consequences.
I mean, I think that's clearly the case in as adults. I don't think people believe that for adolescents, certainly not children 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, that, they need to learn. They need to learn about the rules and regulations. They need to learn about making good choices and good decisions. But clearly the second one, but although even the second one, I'm not sure that's a reason why we would be against prevention because, that cuts across all all economic and racial groups.
Well, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. Let's talk with someone else. This is also someone on a cell phone in Milford. That's line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting program. Sure. Just a couple of quick questions, and I'll go ahead and ring off. I was wondering, I don't know if you covered this already, but as far as the percentage of juveniles that come from broken homes or out of wedlock, I would imagine that these kids would have like 2.5 strikes against them right away, and if that, in fact, is a factor. And also, too, once they enter the system, what is the repeat rate? In other words, I would imagine it would be very hard for a juvenile, once they get indoctrinated, to actually break out of the penal system clean up their act. I was wondering if you had any comments on that.
Sure, great question. There's no sort of real great estimates on the percentage of youth involved with juvenile justice that come from, say, broken homes or out of wedlock. But clearly these youth have a variety of family issues and obstacles that put them at risk for entering the system. But there is sort of evidence to suggest that the youth who do have sort of broader family problems are then subjected to more harsh penalties. And perhaps that just is someone's or the judge's own perceptions around likelihood of rehabilitation. So would they rather invest sort of probation or prevention, not prevention, but probation or in-home services with someone who maybe is coming from a stable family unit relative to someone not coming from a stable family unit? And in terms of sort of recidivism, which I think was the question, mm-hmm. sort of the likelihood of new arrests, it's about 55% recidivism rate within 12 months. And recidivism in this context is simply rearrested.
And I think isn't there not some evidence that shows that putting kids in some kind of secure facility does indeed increase the likelihood that they will commit crimes again and will end up going back? Now, although I suppose that might also have something to do with, you'd have to look at each individual and say, well, what had then been their history to that point? And, had they already been found guilty of committing some crimes or have been getting a lot of trouble, so that maybe the issue wasn't simply that they were put in some secure juvenile facility. But that apparently does have some impact on the likelihood that they're going to go back.
Right. But, there's fairly sophisticated techniques for sort of trying to disentangle the effects, say, of an individual relative to the effects associated with particular placement. Mm-hmm. And given that placements, to some extent, we could have similar groups of kids served in a variety of different programs based on, let's say, this notion of racism, right, that there's some bias in the system that put kids in different programs. You can sort of test sort of placement style effects.
Hmm. Well, just I want to underscore here this issue, the role of race here. Does it matter when you look at where kids are, whether they're charged with anything or not, how serious the charges are, the likelihood that they'll be found guilty, then what it is we do with them afterwards? If you look at different kids of different racial ethnic backgrounds, can you say that their race ends up being a determining factor in how the system treats them?
Oh, absolutely. Controlling for prior offenses, age, gender, the type of offense that they committed, the one that's in front of the judge at the moment. Race is a critical factor, and in particular for African-American youth, at every step throughout the system. And so it's not that it's sort of one stage of this process that is responsible for these disparities that exist later on. So it's not it's all associated to the initial arrest. It's some associated with the arrest. It's some associated with whether it goes to a formal hearing. It's whether the case is adjudicated sort of found guilty, essentially. And then to where they go. Do they go to a group home? Do they go to probation? The vast majority of cases, even adjudicated cases, still get probation. So they're not all moving towards correctional-style programs. But race is clearly a factor at each and every stage throughout this process. So it's this accumulating small effects at each stage phenomenon.
Just to, for a second, I think that to ask a different question, and then I have another caller here I want to get to. The in the justice system, there is this basic idea that we begin we have to begin with determining whether the individual, do they understand the consequences of their actions? Do they understand the legal process that they find themselves in? Are they able in some fashion to assist in their own defense? You know, do they know what's going on? Do they know what they have done? Do they understand the consequences? And if the answer to those questions is no, then we have a different way of, you know, for whatever reason, then we have a different way of treating those people. So we, up front, we ask some basic questions about, does this person understand what's happening to them? I think that there have been some questions raised when it comes to juveniles or perhaps children who get into the justice system, whether in fact that they do understand. Do they really understand what's happening to them? Do they really understand the notion that they did something wrong, that there are consequences? Do they, you know, they're, that's another one of those respects in which children perhaps are, we're going to say that children are different from adults. Is there reason to be concerned about that very thing, about whether or not children, young offenders, really do understand the process that they're in when they get into the justice system?
Right. That's a great question. The short answer is no. I mean, clearly they understand the offense they've committed, and they may understand that it's, you know, it's a problem. It's not acceptable. Mm-hmm. What they don't fully understand are the long-term consequences associated with that particular behavior. And this is, you know, the MacArthur Foundation has, they're really the leading foundation for juvenile justice research. They have a research network on adolescent development and juvenile justice. And they've done a lot of work around this. And in particular with, does it make sense to waive adolescents into the adult court, move a 14 or 15-year-old into the adult court system? And it doesn't. These youth simply don't understand and comprehend the long-term consequences of their actions.
Is it clear where that line is, where on one side you'd say, no, the child doesn't understand, and on the other side that we should really expect that they should begin to understand? Is that going to be different for every individual?
Right. I don't think it's clear like, you know, this 16-year-old knows it and this 15-year-old
doesn't. Yeah.
That would be easy if it was the case.
Okay. We have several callers here. We have about 10 minutes left, by the way, just very quickly. Introduce again our guest, Joseph Ryan. He is assistant professor of social work here at University of Illinois. He's also a faculty fellow in the Children and Family Research Center in the School of Social Work. We're talking about juvenile justice in the United States. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We have several callers here locally, and we'll start in with someone in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Yeah, if we had a situation where, you know, that there was more services to work with families, what percentage actually shouldn't be returned to the family or, you know, the individual? In other words, the situation is so bad for these children. The other one is that what about the foster care system? Does that work, or what would it take there? We're talking about more money, more training. And then finally, I don't recall what the name of that home situation up in Rantoul, you know, where they have what they have the situation where there are like families and they have additional children. I don't remember what the name of that up there. But anyway, any of those areas you'd like to comment on?
Sure. I don't know the Rantoul situation you're referring to, but the first question around more services and what percentage shouldn't be returned, the juvenile justice system doesn't really get involved with taking children forever. That's really the responsibility of the child welfare system if neglect and abuse is going on. So the juvenile justice system sort of never makes a recommendation, or at least they don't have the authority to say we're not returning this child to the home. That's more the role of the Child Welfare Department of Children and Family Services here in Illinois. With regard to the foster care system and whether it works or not, there certainly are problems with the foster care system that put these individuals at particularly high risk of ending up in juvenile justice. Their delinquency rates are about 47% higher than the delinquency rates in the general population. And some of that has to do with placement instability, youth moving from foster home to foster home, the disruption of social bonds and social networks that they have. And the other part has to do with the types of placements that they move into. So we talked about a little bit about the group homes used in the juvenile justice systems. Group homes are also used in child welfare systems. And these placements seem to place individuals at a particularly high risk of entry into juvenile justice. So, for example, one of our projects is in Los Angeles, and we look at the effects of group home placements for victims of child abuse and neglect. And we find that only about 14% of child welfare cases ever end up in a group home placement, yet they account for about 37% of all arrests that are associated with the child welfare system. So there's clearly something about these placements that put individuals at a particularly high risk.
Okay, thank you.
Well, let's go to Urbana. This is line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a question for Professor Ryan. I was wondering if he could touch on some interesting percentages on demographics regarding juvenile placements from committing counties. I noticed that in downstate counties, it's the opposite of the adult offender situation, where 59% roughly downstate counties account for commits, compared to like Cook County, for example, where less or 28% would account for the committing county for juveniles.
I'm not sure what the question is, other than there's clearly regional differences and regional practices that go on with how judges respond to youthful offenders, whether to make dispositions that commit youthful offenders to correctional facilities. But I'm not sure. I don't really do much research on regional effects.
Well, is it? I guess is it the caller saying that the figures show that, for example, if you're a juvenile and you commit a crime in Champaign County, you're more likely to be sent to a juvenile facility than if you were that same juvenile in Cook County?
Right, and that's that's clear. What's not clear is why that's the case. Other than that's there's
yeah, and I guess that's that's I guess what I'm trying to get at is why is it the opposite to the adult population, where a higher percentage or 55% of Cook County commits for adults account for that versus downstate, which is 35%. So it's basically the opposite for juvenile. The higher percentage or 59% represents downstate counties versus 28% in Cook County for juveniles. It's just the opposite. I'm just curious if you had any input on that, and I'll hang up. Thank you.
Okay.
Right. I don't know too much about the commitment rates and the variations across counties, other than what services and what options are available.
Okay. Well, I rather than just hazard a guess, we'll go on to line number three, and this is also another Urbana caller. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. This is Laura Wetzel. I've been a long-time advocate of parent education, and it's been sort of my calling, if you will. Raising children is just unbelievably complicated and difficult, and I think that's a fact that has not been recognized. I believe that parents need education and support from the beginning right through the teen years. Then I hear, well, parents won't come. If we could spend the same energy and finances on advertising parenting classes as we do on, say, fast food, for example, parents would come. We just haven't put the energy into it that we need to. And parent educators are low pay, so they start out without very much experience and, best of intentions and so forth. What I see happening all too often is that parents that do not have adequate skills and information, they do their best, but by the time the kid is in their teens, things have just really fallen apart and they give up. and those kids tend to roam the streets. I've seen them here in my own neighborhood. And who do they find as friends? Well, other children who have been, you know, essentially abandoned. So I just wanted to put my 2 cents in. I think it's so important. I think it can be done. I think parents are not the culprits. They just, they're blamed but not trained.
Well,
thank you.
All right. I thank you for the comment. I expect you would agree.
Yes. And clearly some of the parent education programs have proven successful, and they are relatively a low-cost program. There is some concern with the parent training programs that they're too low cost, and so they don't have the right people in place at times. But clearly some of the home visiting programs, it's this idea of educating parents around what is it like to raise a child. And people go into it with all sorts of different ideas, and it's this mismatch between what parents expect it's going to be like and what reality is actually like.
All right,
which creates the biggest problems.
Thank the caller for the comments. Let's go on to someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know who your guest was. I just caught the tail end of it. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. It was about the statistics on the single parent, broken home and all that, children and the rates of whatever, and he says he has no idea. And then I find out he's a professor or something, and a professor and an expert in this field. He should know more about that.
Well, what I was saying is the idea of the caller asked what percent of children entering the juvenile justice system come from broken homes.
Right. You should know that right off the top of your head. I mean, it's probably overwhelming, the number versus traditional.
Well, I guess I'm not even sure what the caller meant by broken homes. I mean, is that...
Okay, well, let's go with single parent.
So the percent that come from single-parent families.
Versus traditional, that's right.
Right. I mean, I guess I wouldn't lump those in with...
Well, you have to. You have to, because that's the problem that needs to be addressed. You can't just say, let's throw money at something if you don't know what you're throwing money at. That is the problem. If the statistics show that the percentage is overwhelming, then that is the problem.
But I guess so you're throwing money at single-parent status when that may not be the problem. And that
I think the statistics show it is a problem. You should do your research. I mean, I thought you were an expert. You should have those numbers right at the tip of your tongue, that 30%, I'm just throwing this out, 30% versus 8%. Well, then if 30% is from a broken home, single family, or single parent, or whatever, well, then there is the problem.
Well, I think, first of all, you're confusing two terms, single parent and broken home. I think these are entirely two different
things. Well, they didn't get to be a single by not being broken. And you can spin it however you want to, but if it's a broken home, it's probably a single parent. That's the term they use, versus broken. We'll call it single parent.
I guess that's the term perhaps you would use. I'm not sure I would use that term. I mean, all single parent homes are not broken. And clearly, single-parent families, if that's the term we want to use, are overrepresented in child welfare. They're overrepresented in juvenile justice. But that is not the problem. I mean, it's a problem in the sense that fewer resources, fewer supervision hours are associated with that child. But it's not the problem that causes delinquency. Being in a single-parent family doesn't cause delinquency.
Well, is there really, can you, with any kind of reliability, can you say, here's my at-risk checklist, okay? And we'll look at a child and we'll look at all of those factors, ethnic background, socioeconomic status, what kind of relationship do the parents have? Is it problematic? Is it a two-parent household? Has there been a divorce? All those sorts of things, all of the things that you could possibly list. Could you then, based on that, make some prediction of whether a child from that home would be likely to become delinquent, get in trouble, commit crime, get into the system?
Sure. You could create a checklist of various markers. The problem then becomes... And it would seem from this caller's take that his intervention would then be to support marriage, right? That if the problem is single-parent families, everyone needs to be married, and that'll solve the problem of delinquency. That's clearly not the case. You know, a far more sophisticated, rather than looking at demographic checklists, would be looking at social networks. Who are children tied to? Do they have positive relationships in their life? These are the factors that weigh out far more than whether or not they're in a single-parent family.
We're pretty much at the point we have to finish here, and it's not the kind of thing where we're going to have a resolution particularly, but I guess I'm, as a summing up statement, is juvenile delinquency a bigger problem now than it was in the 50s or 60s?
50s or 60s? No.
No.
It's changed, clearly, and our response to juvenile delinquency has changed. So it may seem different. We have more programs. We have more residential facilities. We have a more correctional-style approach, the building of youth prisons. So it has seemed to change, although the official statistics would indicate that it's actually not much worse than it has been.
Well, I think that at that we will stop for this time around. I'm sure there'll be on another day we'll get back to some of these subjects. But for right now, we want to say thanks very much.
Thanks for
being here. Our guest is Joseph Ryan. He is assistant professor of social work here at the University of Illinois, also faculty fellow in the Children and Family Research Center in the School of Social Work.